I'd like to see that. Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for having me. I come from industry, not from academia. So I recognize that I'm an interloper, and I ask for your patience. It may be that what I have to offer here is entirely self-referential. Maybe not. That is self-referential to my industry, to my business. But I would also hope that we have something to share that would be of value or interest to you. I am the founder and CEO of CrossFit. How many of you know about it? Show of hands. Yeah, well, that's cool. We're basically a mom and pop that's experienced some runaway growth. We have from day one without a business plan, without sales staff, without marketing plan, promotion, PR, none of that. We're a web-based, we're a virtual company with employees and throughout the country, and we have affiliate gyms around the world, over 1,000 of them, I guess 1,100 now. And we've met with a considerable success. We're growing at about 1% a day, which is breathtaking, and have since about 2000. But we launched a website in 2001 with a very simple notion, very simple idea that we were going to share our product with the world. And our product was workouts and the resultant adaptations. And that was all we intended to do. And it's still largely what we are doing, what we are about. We call this a workout of the day. It's a WOD, W-O-D. We're probably the largest certifier of trainers in the world today. We certified 5,000 trainers last year, and I think maybe 1,100, 1,200 the year before. And we're probably going to double that again this year. We are certifying internationally. I will be speaking and training, lecturing, and certifying in 6 continents in the next 60 days. So there's a lot going on at CrossFit. But this company was inspired by 2 things. One, I call it a belief in fitness. And the other thing is a belief that fitness is important. And when I say a belief in fitness, what I mean is that we took it as axiomatic that there was an acquired physical capacity that would lend itself generally well to any pursuit. It's awfully bold. It's awfully broad. It's kind of loose there. Probably too fuzzy for scientific work. But interesting on the flip side here. So it's a belief in fitness that there was an acquired physical capacity that lend itself generally well to any activity. And we also believe that it was important, and that is it could make a profound difference to your happiness, your success, your survival, just about anything that you held dear. Our contention was is that fitness would make a difference. And the first of these, the belief in fitness, kind of put an onus on us, put a motivation for us to define fitness, to get away from fuzzy to something that would stand up to greater rigor. And the second part, that fitness was important, was similarly an impetus, a motivation for us to measure fitness. And, it's funny when we started to look into the literature, and I either wanted to find a definition for fitness or was willing to, if we had to create one. And I'll share with you that As a business in championing a cause of developing fitness, I couldn't find from the academic literature, and boy, I had a lot of help. We looked a lot of places, but I couldn't find adequate definition of fitness to suit our needs, not as a business. Now, I'm going to take a bit of an aside here and share something with you. Our goal, our aim, is not quite to advance exercise science, and I make no claims that we've done so, nor do I quite have the interest in it. But what we did have a profound interest in doing, and I think we've met with considerable success, is to advance the technology to develop the technology of advancing human performance. That's a very different kind of thing, something maybe much more like what industry would do than academia would do, but it is at the heart of our program, and it is part of our charter to optimize human performance. And so we start with this finding a definition for fitness or creating one ourselves. So I go to the literature, and I was sorely disappointed in what I found. Whether I went to Mel Siff or Zatsayorsky or wherever we went, and we tried to go everywhere, I just didn't find anything that was consistent with this notion that this belief in fitness, that there was a general physical capacity, an acquired capacity that lent itself generally well to all activities. So we ended up with, at first, three what I call operational and certainly clumsy models of fitness, though they served us well. And the first of these was that we took Jim Colley and Bruce Evans of Dynamax. These are academics with 1 foot in academia in the academy and 1 foot in coaching, from Austin, I believe. And they had posited 10 general physical skills in some of their work. And this was cardiorespiratory endurance, stamina, strength, flexibility, power, speed, coordination, accuracy, agility, and balance. And they didn't do much with that other than just offered them up and gave reasonable definitions of the 10. It seemed like a pretty cool delineation of the gamut of family of adaptations to fitness. Couple of things. One is, I got to mention right out of the gate that nature has no obligation to recognizing these distinctions. These things are radically, completely, entirely interdependent. And that this is an abstraction, and its value lies chiefly in what it might motivate, inspire, or encourage us to do otherwise, and it did certainly with us almost at once, and that is that we took the view, and this was in the words of Colley and Evans, what needed to be done with their work and they had failed to do, was that we posited right out of the gate that he or she was as fit as they were developed in breadth and depth in those 10 capacities, and that a deficiency in any one of these would, relative to any cohort, however you want to do the comparing, would be a measure of your deficiency. Simple enough. Breadth and depth of adaptation based on these physiological responses to an exercise program. The second model we took, and this was kind of a thought experiment, which is called a statistical model of fitness, we said that you could load into a hopper as many skills and drills and training modalities from all of sport. We're going to exclude nothing. So you could put into this thing 400-meter repeats on the track with a two-minute break, max deadlift, one of our classic workouts like a Fran, a Helen, Diane. Our workouts have female names like Storms to acquaint you, for those of you that haven't seen that. But we'd load this hopper up, and our idea was is that you could turn the crank and line up some competitors, and he or she was as fit as they performed relative to some cohort in these various challenges. Now, from the beginning, in working this program where we're trying to advance fitness, advance build a technology of human performance, we decided that we were going to develop a fitness program whose specialty was not specializing, that we were going to develop a fitness program that would protect you or prepare you for the unknown and the unknowable, which are different but certainly related. And so we had it in this hopper model. And a couple interesting things about the hopper that I'll just share with you that relate to our decades of experience with this program. Each of you sitting here now probably has some sense of what it is you'd not like to see come out of the hopper if confronted with that kind of test. Show of hands if you know what I'm talking about. That there would be something you'd like, oh, that wouldn't be good for me if that were to come out. Well, interestingly, it seems like it's certainly when you get around athletes, there's an overwhelming sense of, yes, that is something I don't want to see come out. And I'm going to tell you that there's a greater chance to improve your performance in most sporting efforts, improve your likelihood of survival or dealing with unknown contingencies in pursuing headlong, even if it's you're locked onto a sport like jiu-jitsu or skiing or alpining or lacrosse. I'm going to tell you there's probably more opportunity to improve your performance in your sport chasing headlong that thing you don't want to see come out than putting more time into that thing for which you feel you are ideally qualified should it arise, which is maybe counterintuitive and certainly creates some tension between coach and athletes, but nonetheless a fact for us. So we've got the 10 general physical skills, breadth and depth of that physiological adaptation, and then we've got this balanced capacity, if you will, breadth and depth, of randomly drawn challenges or tasks vis-a-vis some others in a cohort. And then we had a third model, and that third model was a balance of metabolic pathway of the three, now four, I don't care how many you have, it wouldn't change the logic of this, but what we were saying is that he or she was as fit as they were developed in each of the metabolic pathways, the biochemical engines that produce ATP and fuel all of our efforts. So that you wanted to have capacity in the phosphocreatine pathway, in the lactate, glycolytic, and or the oxidative, and that you would be as fit as you were capable in each of these relative to others. So we have a balance in breadth and depth of bioenergetics from the perspective of bioenergetics, from the perspective of skills and drills in the kind of the training milieu, and then from the physiological adaptations that are, again, kind of artificially created, but there nonetheless for us to look at and think about. And this is kind of a shotgun approach. These are operational models. They're a little bit fuzzy. But it caused us to, it was a motivation for us to start measuring. Now, I talk a lot about defining and measurement and experimentation. Let me just give you a little background on me. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, in the suburbs of L.A. in the 1960s, in a community of rocket, in a family of rocket scientists amidst a community of rocket scientists. And I had it instilled in me from a very, very young age that observation, measurement, experimentation, and prediction were critical to science and at the heart of learning. Of knowledge, acquisition of knowledge. And just a little aside, sharing earlier to some laughter, when I was a kid, 10 years old, my father brought home a bag of 1,000 nails. It was labeled 1,000 nails, 1 3/4 inch, and a micrometer. And I had to measure these things, and it took 15 or 20 hours, which is an enormous feat for a kid. I mean, I hated his guts for 6 years after this, but I had to measure each of these nails within a 1/10th of an inch and then plot their frequency for each measurement at each nearest 1/10th. And what I got at the end was a just beautiful bell-shaped curve in the graph, which I learned later was a normal distribution or a Gaussian distribution. But the real lesson there, and this is a potent one, is that often the fabric of the universe or some miracle of understanding, something just breathtaking in its simplicity and elegance, can arise out of something so simple as observing and measurement, as observation and measurement, careful observation and careful measurement. And we're still just starting in science, but I think it's a critical and essential first step. And that kind of mindset carried on to what we were doing here. Now, look, I already told you about that. We felt we had to define fitness. I'm competing in an industry where we're all trying to advance fitness, and yet none of my colleagues, certainly no one in industry, had bothered to define it before. And that was very puzzling to me. It seemed that it would be hard, maybe unethical, even a bit whimsical, to be championing the cause of something that you can't define. It just didn't make sense. So we go through these workouts. We're posting these WODs, these workouts of the day. And we did this in a community, again, through this cultural legacy of the science in which I was raised. And another piece that was hugely influential was it to us in Santa Cruz, California, where we really launched the web-based aspect of this program, was that we had some superstars, some heroes from the open source community working within our gym. And they inspired us to launch a website and to put our workouts up there and to post the data that we were getting from the workouts. And so we ended up with, ultimately, and it's true to this moment, to this very minute, that we had an open source community where our methods, our results, and our criticisms were all perfectly public for the entire world to see. And we were buttressing what we did with measurable, observable, repeatable data, right? And we tried to limit our interaction, discussion, and analysis to speaking of the effect of these workouts. What do they do? What is the impact? The efficacy, what is the time rate of that adaptation? And safety, how many are sidelined or left behind along the way? And in fact, it's our consideration today, and we call this in total evidence-based fitness, that our discussion of fitness ought to be limited to, when we talk about programs, to the effect, the time rate of that effect, to its efficiency, and to the safety, how many are sidelined along the way, and that this needs to be supported with data that is measurable, observable, and repeatable. Okay? Very simple charter. But what it did is it made us, it built an open source community where we very quickly found co-developers and some of the very best minds in science, in physics, in chemistry, in biology, in fitness, in coaching, amongst trainers and athletes. And that's a really kind of the hallmark of CrossFit at this point, that we have enormous resources at our disposal, and in physicians too, in fact, but we have just a great confederation of practitioners that are given to these same kinds of thoughts in terms of rigor, what qualifies something as being worthy of our efforts or not. Now, the measurement part. At first, it would look like something like, say, Fran. I'll just talk about a classic workout. Let me see a show of hands if you know what Fran is. God bless you. Yeah, sorry about that. This is with a 95-pound load, and I'll just give you the male's numbers. I think the female is 65. Is that right, Nicole? Yeah. It's a 95-pound front squat push press, so down to up, 21 reps. There's no requirement these be done contiguously. I just need 21 reps, okay? You might do 7, 7, and 7. You got it, or 5, 6, and 10. But you got to get to 21 before moving on to the pull-ups. And in the pull-ups, it's 21. Back to this front squat push press that we've abbreviated as a thruster. I need 15 there, 15 of the pull-ups, then 9 and 9, and stop the clock. All right? So what we'd have is Mark Ripito. Here's today's date is, April 4th? Is that where we're at? 3rd? 4th? What are we here? Yeah, April 4th, and quarter to 2. He did Fran at whatever body weight he is, and the time was 10 minutes. That's what the recording looked like. That's what the observation looked like on paper. And we played with these over the years, and we got enough of them, and then we started looking at this thing a little more systematically, a little more like a scientist might, in fact, and it became abundantly clear that we had a reasonably precise and significantly accurate measure of this output that could be better than just talking about Fran in 10 minutes or 11 minutes. That is, what we found is that we could estimate where the athlete's center of mass is and watch its displacement and weigh both the athlete and the load and measure their movement, and we could actually distill this effort into some number of foot-pounds per minute of work extended over so many minutes. And as long as the athlete came back to this effort with a similar body weight and its similar limb lengths, that the work would be constant for that athlete under that exercise. And we started plotting this data. We started looking at how many foot-pounds per minute were being expressed over how many minutes. And boy, what a change that was. What insight that gave us. It really, really shed a lot of light on what we were doing. But in the final analysis, what happened is, after you look at enough of this data, it caused us to, so we have these three operational definitions of fitness that I said are kind of clumsy. We got the balance of the 10 general physical skills, and we've got the turning the hopper, and then this balance of these development of these metabolic pathways. But what happened is that after looking at this data long enough, we realized that we could refine our definition of fitness and move away from these clumsy definitions and express fitness as work capacity measured across broad time and modal domains. And let me show you what that would look like. I don't like the units on here. It was for not one of our best, but it'd be better unitless. But essentially what's happening here is, at any duration, we could come up with a series of exercises, 2, 3, 4, 5, I don't care, the more the better. And what we could do is, at, say, 10 seconds, I could come up with 3 or 4 different exercises, workouts, if you will, that we could then resolve to some number of foot-pounds per minute expressed, and then take an average for that point. And we could do this at a minute. We could do this at 2 minutes. I could do this at 5 minutes. We could make that x-axis logarithmic. It doesn't matter. Take it out to hours, days. It doesn't matter. And graph this thing. And so what I have here, I've got power measured in foot-pounds per minute or second on that. That really screws up the graph now when you see per second. That's just profoundly wrong, but doesn't matter. It's the graphics, people. We've got power on the y-axis, and I've got duration of effort on the x-axis. And if I take, again, at each duration a handful of tests and average those and graph that out, I have a power curve for that athlete measured against broad time from short duration to long duration in modal domains, doing all kinds of different stuff. And the area under that curve is the work capacity for that athlete. And we came to see, took a couple of years of looking at this and pondering and arguing and thinking and analyzing, but what we came to see, that this is actually a workable definition of fitness. Work capacity measured across broad time and modal domains. And in fact, it nicely includes the 10 general physical skills. They are included within that data. It would be reflected. That is cardiorespiratory endurance, stamina, strength, flexibility, power, speed, coordination, accuracy, agility, and balance. And we also came to see that this kind of output had more significance to us than any of these things that we now see as correlates, like, for instance, VO2 max. If I were to ask you, would you take an increase in VO2 max for a decrease in work capacity across broad time and modal domains? Mark Ripito says no. Most coaches would tell you, hell no, that wouldn't be worth it. Now, if I were having a maximum sustainable oxygen consumption race, then yes, I'll take the VO2 max every time over work capacity. But I don't think that's really what happens in the field, in sport, in nature, in combat, in any of the applications to fitness in our daily lives. I don't think we're racing maximal oxygen O2 uptake, right? You might. I mean, I've done it. I've had VO2 VO2 max races with people and max heart rate races. I've done that. But it isn't really what happens in sport, and it's not what happens in applied fitness either.